Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, here's the question that we'll be talking about. Could something as seemingly simple as getting families to sit down on a regular basis together for meals, could something like that actually have significant and measurable benefits for families, particularly for children? And the answer to that question is yes. As a matter of fact, there have been a number of studies that have shown that in families who regularly have dinner together, children do better in school. They seem to have fewer behavior problems. They have lower rates of all those risky behaviors that we would rather they not do. And even though that sometimes in a family where things are very busy and heavily scheduled, this may not be the easiest thing to do, there's good reason to actually make the effort to do that. And this morning, that's what we'll be talking about here in this first hour of Focus 580. And our guest for the program is Angela Wiley. She is Assistant Professor of Applied Family Studies in Human and Community Development here at the U of I. She's also an Extension Specialist in Family Life Education and does a lot of research on parenting and more recently on work-life management. And she will be giving a talk along with Reed Larson, who also is a professor here at the University of Illinois, about this subject. And this will be taking place next week on Monday, the 17th, at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. And this is a program that's being sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. It's their spring 2006 lecture. And anyone who would be interested in attending should feel welcome. It's free and open to anybody. And as we talk this morning, we'll talk a little bit about what we know about family mealtime. And what I would encourage people who are listening to do is maybe call in and tell us some stories about family mealtime at their house and things that they do to make that special. And we were just chatting here beforehand, this needn't simply be about people who have children in their family. There are other couples for whom this is also a very important time to take time to slow down, to sit down, have something nice and spend time together. So it's not just about children. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David, for having me. It's a wonderful topic and one that many, many people can relate to, something as basic as eating together.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I was really surprised as I started out to think about this and look at least at some of a little bit of what's been written about this, that in fact there are so many studies done by different people, scholars at what you and folks here at the University of Illinois have, people at Michigan have, and organizations as diverse as the Council of Economic Advisors has done these studies looking at really significant benefits to children in all these ways that we've talked about that come from the experience, apparently that seem to come from the experience of sitting down with their parents and with their siblings and having time together, sitting down and having dinner. And obviously this is more than just eating. It's not just mm-hmm. about eating. It's about everything else that happens as a result of getting together and doing that.
I think the book that Professor Larson and I put together is entitled Family Mealtimes as a Context of Development and Socialization. When we began thinking about what kind of scholarship exists about family mealtimes, and we began looking, we found a lot more than we thought. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we hear in the popular press about mealtimes is really rather dire, right? So it's the idea that mealtimes are important, but they're disappearing, mm-hmm. you know, going the way of the dinosaur, and that we need to do something about that as a culture. It was kind of a starting point for us to think about that popular concern. And then when we actually went out to look at the scholarship, what we found was, well, a lot of interesting work going on, but scholars who weren't talking to one another because they were in diverse fields. So we had nutritionists you know, doing large epidemiological studies where they indeed do look at the content of what is eaten. And then we had people in psychology who were interested more in the interactions that are happening around the mealtime table. So it really was in some ways an eye-opener for us as scholars to find so many different people looking at the question and yet not coming together and having a conversation with one another. Mm-hmm. That's what we tried to do, I think, in this volume.
Well, you know, you pointed something that I think is very interesting. And if you look at popular media and what has been written about this, the impression that you get is that this, that the family mealtime has been sacrificed to the busy lifestyle that many people have, many families have, particularly, this may particularly apply to middle class folks, but the families where both parents work and children are in school and are involved in a lot of extracurricular activities. And, you know, people will know the kind of story and the kind of situation we're talking about, where somebody is always going somewhere, mm-hmm. to school, to work, to sports, to dance classes, to music lessons, to, you know, something like that. And that for that reason, it seems in a lot of families, it's very difficult just even to find the time to manage mm-hmm. to get everybody's schedules lined up, so that they, in fact, can sit down at least a few nights a week and everybody sit down at the table and have a meal together. And we've read and heard about that a lot. And in fact, some people might say, well, yes, that is what our family is like. What really surprised me, though, is that when you take a look at the studies that have asked the question, well, how often do families get together for meals? In fact, it doesn't really seem that the family meal is as endangered as all this talk would have us believe.
Yeah, I think there are two issues there that are very important. One is, was it ever what we think it was? Was there ever a time when families came together every day, you know, 2 to 3 times a day and ate together in this kind of very nostalgic, you know, Norman Rockwell kind of way? That's certainly one issue. And then the other issue is, what are families doing today? So before we can actually compare those, we need to understand both of those things. And the studies that you refer to, and there are a number of them, and of course, you know, it depends on how you ask the question and that sort of thing. But what we know is that 55% of children, families with children between 6 and 11, report that they eat together 6 to 7 days per week. That's over half report that they eat together every day. And then if we look at 4 times a week, you know, are you able to gather for a communal meal 4 or more times? We find that 80% of families report that they do that when they have children 6 to 11. Now, it goes down a little as your kids get older. I'm sure that all of our listeners know what happens when you have adolescents in your household. They get involved in activities and then it goes down a bit. But even with them, we still see that 42% of them eat together with their families 6 to 7 days a week. So enough of the numbers. What we know for sure is that families are doing it a lot more than I think we're thinking, our worst fears. But then if we go back and say, was there ever really a time when the majority of American families kind of came together and ate 6 to 7 times per week or more? The answer to that question, according to our historian who looked at American family meals, the evolution of those from the Victorian times up through the mid-1960s, and then we did some research to say what's going on now, was, you know what, it probably never resembled that ideal picture for most American families. You know, families didn't even really eat together in the way that we think of it until urbanization, industrialization, the separation of work and home. Prior to that, people ate sort of based on the calendar. And what I mean by that is, you know, they ate their big meal in the middle of the day. People kind of came and went. I'm talking pre-Victorian times now. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't until around the 1950s, really, when we saw that kind of focus on family meal times as a special ritual. And it was for a reasonably short period of time that was an important part of the lives of many Americans. So we know it's still happening. We know it may not look like that ideal picture in many cases, but we know that that ideal picture probably was a rarity in most families' lives anyway.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. And perhaps I should also introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Angela Wiley. She is Assistant Professor of Applied Family Studies in Human and Community Development at the U of I. She's also an Extension Specialist in Family Life Education and has done research on parenting and also on work-life management. And we're talking about the potential benefits of at least a few times a week having families all sit down together for a family meal. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have somebody here calling from Watsika on a cell phone, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. David, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, wonderful program. Just a couple of quick comments, and since I'm on the cell, I'll go ahead and ring off. I actually called my wife up when I heard the topic and said, you got to put the radio on and listen. Because we actually had this conversation. We have two small children, and my wife just said, she goes, you know, it's really a labor of love to have dinner together. We were married about 10 years before we started our family, and like I said, we had two small children. And, boy, I tell you, we think back about before we had kids and we had dinner and, you know, it was nice and so on and so forth. So you really don't think there's a benefit until you see other kids who don't have that process happening. And you see in your own children, they socialize so much better. They know how to talk, how to sit, how to eat, how to converse. And so much of that, I think, is gone now, either because of our hectic schedules or because of the disintegration of the unit family. I know myself, I was born and raised in the 50s and 60s, and my mom and my dad always made an effort, and there was four of us, four kids, to have dinner together. And I can tell you that I'm sure at times they wish that it was just the two of them. But I do think it's a very important process. You get to share the events of the day, but also you get to train your kids on how to eat and how to act in a social or public gathering. And as I mentioned, I hate to see that go, by the side on that, because I think it has so many additional benefits. And obviously, David, as you said, just, you know, eating of the food. Sometimes you don't think you're getting anywhere with the kids, but of course, kids are kids. But then when you see them in other social events, you said, well, you know what, maybe it's paying off. Maybe it's having a beneficial effect. So anyway, that's just a couple of quick comments. I'll go ahead and ring off and listen. Thanks.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you. Well, I'd say that that's an excellent illustration of one of the things that one of the points I think that you want to get across, that the kinds of things that the caller talks about are indeed potential benefits of having everybody sit down to the meal.
There are definitely potential benefits. I loved it when you talked about sort of engaging them in conversation. It's a really important benefit, even for young children. The fact that you're getting them involved and the training that you mentioned is very often a training that involves engaging them. Right, so having them be part of the process, part of the conversation, they get to learn what is a suitable topic of conversation in my family. What's a tellable story? Mealtimes that are rich with conversation are often rich with explanations, either explanations that children elicit from you. So they ask you a question that engages you in giving them, for example, new vocabulary words, words that they might not have had the opportunity to learn in other settings, but they get to learn them in this kind of very real, engaging, lived kind of context. I wanted to mention that in many cases we know that children who participate in mealtimes, shared mealtimes with their families, I think David mentioned early on, tend to have better outcomes later related to literacy. So they turn out to have usually bigger vocabularies, and they turn out to have better reading test scores. In fact, in one of the chapters of this book, our authors did some research and found that mealtime is a better predictor of later literacy for children than is book reading. So that's a surprising finding to many people. I'm not suggesting that you not read with your children, but I'm suggesting that mealtimes provide a unique context for giving children rich information where they're not only hearing it, but they're participating in it. So we think that's part of what makes those situations so unique.
Mm-hmm.
If I might also mention, I want to be careful. Merely the act of having mealtimes is not sufficient to predict all these wonderful outcomes we're talking about. It is also possible that mealtimes can be, how shall I say it, a nest of strife. now, that's important to say. We expect that mealtimes are going to be chaotic, especially with young children. I mean, there's just... I have a daughter who's 7, and it's very vivid in my mind. When she was younger, I think I sat for about a third of the mealtime spread out, my husband and I both at that time. So it isn't necessary, it isn't sufficient to simply have the meal, but to have this context where you're engaged with each other, you're telling stories, you're remembering past events, you're warm. And setting that kind of an environment. I really appreciate the caller's description. It's a beautiful example.
Yeah, and we'd be happy to have other calls. People want to tell us stories. People mm-hmm. want to ask questions, make comments, whatever. 333-WILL or 9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. There, we just gave an illustration. You talked a little bit about one set of potential benefits, that good dinnertime conversation can be actually good for the verbal and mm-hmm. literary mm-hmm. Development of
yes.
children. But the caller also touched on something else, and that is yet another bunch of things that you think actually can be a positive benefit, that having that opportunity to sit down around the table with the family does give you an opportunity to teach things about manners, about how to behave, and also about, it's an opportunity to do some values education.
Absolutely.
And to get across to your kids what you think are important. And again, that's an additional set of things beside the things that maybe have to do with how kids end up doing in school. The other just have to do with generally how they behave generally, and what we consider to be appropriate behavior and what is not.
Mealtimes provide, again, this kind of context where children are actively participating in their own socialization, in this case, if I can use that term. So the information that they're gathering, they're working with and working on and negotiating in many ways, is a very rich description about what it means to be a person in their family and in their broader culture. So they're getting through both the stories that they hear told, the language that they hear going back and forth. They're getting their parents' opinions about important matters. So they're gathering lots and lots of information about that and issues related to values. I mean, in part, it depends on what you use those mealtimes for. You know, we, in the title of our talk that we'll be doing Monday evening, we talk about mealtimes as an opportunity, right? They provide parents with an opportunity to give lots of good and rich and interesting things to their children. And that includes, you're right, this kind of larger socialization about, you know, how does one behave? And I'm thinking of some good stories that I've heard children tell in the data that we've seen. You know, so they'll come home and they'll talk about something that happened on the playground. Let's use that as an example. The parent has an opportunity at that point to really draw out some very rich moral and ethical implications of the activities that went on the playground. Someone got knocked down. The parent has an opportunity to speak to that issue, not in a preachy way and often not even in a direct way, but more often the information can come through how they engage the child in that topic. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, sure, sure. And I think it's also, and people I'm sure will also know, and it's also worth noting that for a lot of people, marking cultural or religious rituals
mm-hmm.
involve a meal, involve
right.
coming together as a group around a table at some particular special times. Maybe you eat particular special things. There are certain things that you do, but that, you know, that can be a time when you really do educate around things that you think for you, for your family, for whoever you are, for the traditions you come out, stuff that's really, really important.
Absolutely. And I love that you mentioned that sort of ritualistic aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, both ritual and routine, right? So the mealtimes that happen on a daily basis that may not have any incredibly overt ritualistic aspect. For example, most of my family meals don't involve, you know, highly specialized foods that take, you know, a day to cook, like a Thanksgiving dinner. But there are ritualistic aspects to the family meal. So, for example, we try to light a candle every evening to symbolize the beginning of our dinner. And then we have my daughter blow it out at the end, sort of symbolizes the ending of that family meal. But those ritualistic aspects, both the sort of important religious, so I'm thinking Passover, right, is one that's probably on many people's mind right now. Very important religious and historical significance of that meal. And when children are pulled into that and made part of that, it becomes a very rich part about their memories, about their childhood, a very rich part.
We're at the midpoint here of the conversation. I have one caller ready to go and another I think we'll get right to. And I do again want to mention the fact that our guest this morning, Angela Wiley, will be giving a talk along with a colleague here also from the University of Illinois, Reed Larson, about this very matter, about the various kinds of opportunities that mealtimes can present for helping to raise healthy and resilient kids. This is an event. It's sponsored by the Pamford Chef Family Resiliency Program. It's their spring lecture for 2006. And it'll be taking place next Monday, that's the 17th, at 7:30 in the evening at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum, which is on the U of I campus. It's on Gregory Street in Urbana, and not very far from the Family Resiliency Program's new, brand-new building, which I think also before that they're going to be giving an open house so people can walk around and see the new place.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that everybody associated with this program is very excited and very happy to have the new building to be in.
Contributing to our resilience as a faculty.
I'm sure it is. We have several other people to talk with, and we'll get to that in just a second here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Let's talk with some callers. And Urbana is an Urbana person next, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Three things. One, I agree totally that meals are a wonderful opportunity for the family to get together, to catch up on what's happened during the day, to make plans. I just think it's a very important time. Two, I was surprised about the question about whether there were families who actually ate together in the past. I'm 72 and my husband is 75, and we were chatting before I got on the phone, and each of us had families where we ate the meals together. If we came home from school, of course, it was just with mother, but that was the expectation. There really wasn't any other opportunity. Of course, as we got older and were teens and so forth and had evening activities, then that might have changed. But mother fixed meals, and we ate them when they were prepared, and that wasn't something that was discussed. It was just the way we behaved. So I understand that a lot of people have a lot of different ways of doing things, but I and my friends, I know, my girlfriends, we all grew up that way, that we were just, you know, that dinner time was the family sat down and that's what you did, and it was a good time to check in. Third, I think today's families, young families, are just so overwhelmed with activities. So many times both partners are working outside the home for pay. The kids even have their own activities starting at a very young age. And it is very difficult for them to schedule when everybody will be there. And I see that, and I think it's a lost opportunity. But the few young families I'm aware of are, it's almost harem scarum. You know, where are you going to be? When are you going to do this? I've got to work in the yard. And my heart just goes out to them because they don't seem to value, and even if they did, it would be so difficult to create a time when everybody's available. So those are my three comments.
All right. Well, thank you. And you can respond to those any way you like.
Okay. Thank you, caller. I really appreciate that. And I know for many, many of us, we definitely had families where mealtimes were set and valued. And I think probably for most families that is the case. There's a lot of variability in how they do it. So in some families, and particularly, as I mentioned, from the Victorian era in the middle classes and in the 1950s in families particularly where there was a mom available who could stay home, dinner times have always maintained that kind of steady ritualistic aspect to them, routine and rituals. And so we know that. We just also know, though, that there is a lot of variability in how families have managed to do that. In spite of that, and in spite of, I'm glad you brought up the overscheduled families, one of our previous Pampered Chef Family Resilience Program speakers, Dr. Bill Daugherty, who's from Minnesota, came and talked with us about overscheduled families. And we know for sure that that is the case. Many, many families are heavily, heavily involved. Their children, 2, 3 kids, all involved in different activities. So they're very pressed to find time to have meals together. And yet, the statistics that I read earlier, we know that many of them are still doing it. Now, it may not look the way that it used to look in large part. So, you know, some of those meals may be much more based on convenience type foods. They may be, you know, put together. So many families, for example, are not eating dinner together every night, but they're getting up and having breakfast together.
Uh-huh.
So we still see that families are valuing this and they view it as important. Most families, they're just taking some different roads to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate your bringing that up.
Well, I'm so glad that you and your colleague are assets in the community, and I am so looking to your presentation on Monday. Mm-hmm. I think it will be just a wonderful opportunity to hear that.
Wonderful.
Okay.
I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. Well, let's go on. We'll talk next with someone in Aurora. This would be our toll-free line, our line 4. Hello.
Yes. I wanted to tell you something that isn't exactly of what we're talking about, but it happened this week, and I think it's comical to some extent, and it was an attempt on my part to help my daughter's family who lives next door. She's working on her master's. She doesn't have time to cook, and she just got school 2 years ago, got sole guardianship of a Hispanic child. So trying to get everything all together, I decided to make a Mexican quiche. And I was very happy about it, and it looked wonderful, and I knew it had all the right ingredients. So I wrote a note to my daughter, left it on the fence, and she came over for it, and it looked wonderful. And the outcome was that nobody liked it, and they fed it to the dog. And I just laughed about it. I thought, well, that's the way it went. Next time I'll make something that at least my daughter will like, you know, one of the dishes from way back. And maybe the girls will eat it, but I know my daughter will. So, and talking about the time that they have together. You know, they do have time in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very good time because they're very close, you know, two in the front, two in the back, one in the front. And the conversation has to be, and they have to hear each other. They can't go away. And I think the time in the car is driving to some place is very valuable. So thanks for talking about this. It's a great topic. Bye-bye.
Right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you, caller. I'm sorry that your culinary efforts were not appreciated, but I do want to say that the importance of extended kin support cannot be underestimated. For the families, especially those who are, you know, overscheduled and in those years when their kids are young and at home. So the kind of support that you're offering can often help to make mealtimes possible for those families and kind of integrate in some of those extended kinship interactions that are also very important for children. Last thing I wanted to just say real quick is I'm very much in agreement with you about car time, and it's a good example of creativity in connection. So what we see is a lot of young families who are really forced to come up with very creative ways to get involved. We know that for many adolescents, car time is a great time because they don't have to look you in the eye, and they can talk about whatever they want without having to make that oh-so-threatening eye contact. So I'm glad to know that she's making use of that.
Yeah. Let me raise another issue that may be on some people's minds. And again, this goes to the busy, overscheduled family. Some people might hear this talk about all the benefits of family mealtime and say, here, now, this could become yet another burden. Mm-hmm. And not to run down mankind, the male part of it, but I think we probably know that in a lot of families, the person who ends up being the most responsible for keeping things running and getting food on the table is going to be mom. And here, I worry that this is the kind of thing that could end up being a greater burden and particularly falling on one individual in the household who already may be feeling overburdened as it is. I mean, how do you make sure it doesn't get to be something like another, get to feel like another commitment that we have to somehow find energy and organization to make happen?
Well, the first thing that I would like to do, thank you for bringing it up, is to point out again this issue of not trying to live up to an unrealistic ideal. So this idea that we all need to be Martha Stewart, oh, she may not be a good example anymore, but that we all need to be sort of these, you know, fancy homemakers creating gourmet meals for our families to bring them together, and that the burden is all on, or primarily, you mentioned to me that you do the cooking in your family, and I think that's happening more and more, but I think it is still without a doubt. The work of my colleague Joe Pleck in Human and Community Development and others have shown that women still are handling much of the brunt in this domain. So one of the ways that we begin is by putting that ideal aside and by saying we're going to find creative and low-pressure ways to make this happen. We don't have to have a gourmet meal, in fact. In fact, we probably don't want to have that kind of pressure because then we're not going to enjoy it. And our family's not even going to be able to enjoy it. So I'd like to see people get a little more sort of creative and relaxed at the same time, not worrying about making it perfect, but understanding that the important part of this is to be sitting down together. And if sometimes that has to be a meal out, but the family is connecting, if sometimes it has to be carry home, if sometimes it has to be something that's quick and easy, getting a little stockpile of quick and easy things that can be done, and sharing the work, you know, pulling your kids in, bringing them, making it. I just spoke with Mike Sola out in the lobby, and Mike told me that he had his daughters making manicotti, and it turned out to be this fun experience. Sure, the manicotti didn't turn out perfect, but it was this fun experience where he and his girls were able to kind of do this project together. So I don't want particularly mothers, but parents in general to feel this sense of, oh no, if I'm not having seven meals, you know, a week with my children, I'm going to put them at an academic disadvantage, cause them mental health issues. That's not what I'm saying. What we are saying is, to the extent that we can understand the value of these things and make a commitment to getting as many of them in as we can in as least stressful way as possible, we'll all be better off.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to, I believe, a caller in Champaign on line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that there are simple preparation mm-hmm. chores that children can do, mm-hmm. like setting the table. Mm-hmm. Salad comes in a bag now, so they could make a salad bowl. And I think it's important to remember that. Not that children have to do really difficult things when they're so young, but they'd feel really proud of themselves for helping, I think.
Thank you.
That's my comment.
They feel not only proud often, but they feel more invested in the meal. So I think that some of my colleagues in the field of nutrition would say that when children get involved, they're more likely to eat more of what they make. So if you have them make the salad, they may be more invested in eating the salad because they created it. I certainly know it works with my daughter. Caller, thank you.
All right. And to another caller, this is someone in Indiana, line three. Hello.
Hello. Just as a comment, I know if sitting at my grandfather's dinner table, if I said something about taking my grandmother's meal and feeding it to the dog, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now. That's for sure. I guess I'm coming at this hopefully a little different way. I was reared by three different families within the large family group, and I remember at times eating with the family was not a joy.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was very frustrating at times, because this was the time my stepfather chose to straighten me out on the things I did the previous day or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then this would end in arguments and stuff, and I sort of... From that experience, I just wonder if, you know, besides this happy-go-lucky 1950s childhood thing that I went through, though I believe it was a golden age, there were parts of that golden age were quite disturbing, and I just wonder if there's any studies done on the other end of the family influence on children when the family is, you know, discordant and something like that. I guess, secondly, challenge, I guess I look at it now, as living with that many families, is I had to bring sort of different personalities to that table. One table, my own personality was not liked or accepted, and so I had to, you know, do other things to please people that way. I just wonder how involved and how down deep you get on these studies, or whether it's just large general, population, and you ask questions, and that's that. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Certainly, we know that the family table can be a place for conflict.
The dark side.
Yeah.
The dark side of the family table, certainly. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences. Some of the studies that are done, you know, I mentioned that there are scholars that do work on this topic in many areas. There are a group of scholars, and we have some of them represented in the volume that we'll be talking about on Monday, do work in more of a clinical area where their interest is in whether or not participation in mealtimes predicts sort of mental health and well-being kinds of outcomes for children. And indeed, they look at smaller samples, caller, and are interested in the kinds of interactions that happen. So the one where you describe with your stepfather, you know, taking the opportunity to discipline you at the mealtime table is certainly not what we're recommending for families to do. That tends to create an atmosphere where, you know, you have strife and conflict. Not that all conflict is bad, mind you, but what they find is predictive of positive emotional and mental outcomes is when mealtimes are both kind of planned and structured and predictable rituals. So that element of them is important, but certainly not sufficient. You can have something that's very ritualistic and planned and yet, you know, has a very dark negative side to it. In those meals, we also like to see family members communicate constructively and openly, do things like problem solving, talk about important and sensitive topics, but do so in a way that is facilitative of coming up with solutions, bringing everybody to the table, figuratively in this sense. And we also want to know that they're filled with meaning and overall kind of positive atmosphere, memories of shared past experiences. Lots of times you see people doing a lot of insider talking at meals. So as an outsider, if you come into a family meal and watch it, those that are really facilitative of development are often those which are kind of difficult to interpret as an outsider, because they're talking about shared past experiences, may use things like nicknames. We like to see overall positive, open, and direct communication. And when we don't, then we know that mealtimes are really not serving a positive function, but can be quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. It just occurs to me, though, that if you really, I wonder if you have something really difficult to talk about,
mm-hmm.
if there's potential for conflict, that maybe that's not, I don't know, is that really the best time and the place to do it?
I guess I'd call a family meeting separate from the meal. Mm-hmm. You know, so if there are topics that need to be discussed that are, I don't want to say that people should never talk about difficult things at the table, because sometimes it happens, and I don't want to suggest that there are long-term negative ramifications from that. But simply that, in general, I would say the practice, the research suggests that the practice should be to keep those meal times as much as positive as possible, and leave that other stuff that needs to be taken care of for other places.
Yeah. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. Our guest is Angela Wiley. She is Assistant Professor of Applied Family Studies in Human and Community Development at the U of I. She's also an Extension Specialist in Family Life Education and has done research on parenting and on work-life management. And she and a colleague here from the U of I, Reed Larson, will be giving a talk about the benefits of family meals as part of the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. They're sponsoring this. It's the Spring 2006 lecture. This is next Monday in the evening at the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. Anybody who's interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. Questions here continued, or comments continue to be welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller in Muhammad, someone on the cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to add to the previous caller and the response made. I came from a family of six, and I remember once, maybe 10 years ago, one of my sisters told me that she felt that she was verbally abused by my father because he always insisted that everybody have discussions at the dinner table. And when I said I didn't feel that way at all, she said I was in denial, and I said, well, you know, I enjoyed it. I really look forward to that. And maybe it's just that you're sensitive to that. And it seemed to me that the best way to handle that, where different people at the table have different attitudes or feelings about the dinner, and we eventually did this as we got older, was to not only have the conversations with my father, but for the people who didn't want to participate, they would just converse among themselves. There were enough people all around that we would usually have two or three conversations going on at the same time. And that way, people had something they could do if they wanted to. And I think one of the hardest things is dealing with the fact that each child has its own personality, and not everybody is going to enjoy any one mode of communication at the table. And you have to just allow for that. And if you're lucky enough to be in that environment, that's great. I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I guess that also does indeed go to the issue that, you know, conversation is supposed to be a two-way street.
Right.
The idea is not someone that should be giving a lecture or that someone should really dominate. But ideally, I guess the idea would be to try to get everybody involved.
Participating on their own terms. You know, I like the caller's plug for flexibility. You know, so clearly if we set up a mealtime where we're all worried and concerned to make it this perfect experience where we're getting in some stories and explanations and rare words, some exciting vocabulary that our children can glom onto, we could also do the same kind of inflexible approach with, you know, for example, food. Like you can get into many, many, many power struggles with children regarding food. One example from one of our authors involved a father. The whole mealtime dissolved into an argument over whether or not the child would eat the turkey. And so it becomes this really negative environment where a lot of kind of power struggles can get played out. Or it sounds like the caller's sister was kind of quiet but felt very resentful about that mode of communication being imposed on her. So flexibility and sort of creating that positive atmosphere by having it be something people want to participate in as much as possible is certainly the way to go.
Yeah. Well, you just touched on something that again is another one of the potential benefits, or can be a potential benefit, and that in as much as parents struggle with their children about what they're going to eat, that this is what happens with family meals apparently has a great influence on children, and as they grow up, their attitudes toward nutrition, what they eat and how they eat. And again, it is and obviously that it's not always a thing that's going to go really smoothly, but it does seem to be that kids who do have this experience have healthier they have a better idea what's good food, they have a better idea what's good nutrition, they have a better idea about what's healthy eating patterns. You know, maybe if maybe you'll have kids that have fewer, the risk of them having eating disorders and kind of all problems involving food seems to be less. Mm-hmm. I mean, it also seems to be an opportunity to give them some positive messages about what healthy eating is about.
I mean, certainly the opposite can be true, too, right?
Sure.
But what we do know is that, a lot of people are talking and worrying about sort of some of the nutritional crises that we have currently in this country. And so the most recent figures are that approximately 32% of children are overweight or at risk of becoming overweight. That's really an appalling figure. We've seen rises in type 2 diabetes among children, et cetera. So we know something's going on. Hmm. And also the USDA estimates that 94% of adolescents have a poor quality diet or a diet in need of improvement. Now, all of that said, we know that when children do eat meals with their family, and it's cross-sectional data, but we're seeing the pattern happen again and again, there's a strong positive association between eating meals with your family and increased levels of fruit, grains, vegetables, calcium-rich foods showing up over and over again. So what we're hopeful about is that if we can get families to kind of come together around these meals, that we see modeling on the parts of parents, good or bad. I'd like to see more good than bad, but we see parents sort of showing kids this is what, and if they simply have available vegetables and fruits, for example, they're more likely to eat them, I mean, clearly, than if they're not available and easy to get to. So, yeah. It's another benefit, and one that in many ways is more intuitive, but one that I think we need to underline again.
Sure. Well, let's see if we can get at least one more caller here. That would be someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
I think one of the challenges for people who have teenagers is the varying schedules, and especially if teenagers are involved in sports, this can throw off their eating schedules because if they've, for instance, if they're running cross country, they may not be hungry when they come home, but they may be hungry during school. It's quite a challenge, and there are suggestions out there. At one point in his life, one of my kids was delving into stuff in the refrigerator. I said, "Yeah, you're gonna ruin your meal," and he said, "Mom, I don't believe in eating on an empty stomach." I thought, yeah, that's the deal. He's got a much bigger appetite because of all the calories he's consuming, and it didn't throw off his meal. I've noticed we have a rental property on campus, and I've noticed that students over the last few years cook less and less. I was particularly brought home because the pilot light went out on the stove, and the guys there didn't tell me about it for a week, and they couldn't figure out how to light it. They thought there was a gas leak. And the reason that they thought there was a gas leak is they weren't using the stove. They hadn't realized that the pilot light was out. And they just go out to eat all the time. I know I said to them, you know, guys, it's a whole lot cheaper if you cook some meals instead of going out and eating at McDonald's or whatever. Plus, it can be healthier. You can rotate the meals. You know, I think that we're depriving our kids of an important experience by not teaching them some easy meals to make on their own for when they start out on their own. And so I'm suggesting that to the new group. I said, emailed them and said, you know, one of the things you might think about doing over the summertime is asking your family for easy to make recipes and asking for favorite things that you really, really enjoy and learn how to make a few of those. So I'm also thinking of giving them some suggestions about quick recipes that you can just toss together and that are healthy. And I think all of us could use a few of those. Maybe, David, that would be another topic to revisit. You've probably talked about this on the cooking program you do once a month. But
sure, yeah. Things that are good, that are healthy, that taste good, and that are easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
Toss them together. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. You probably wouldn't want to add anything to that. You probably say, yeah. Okay.
I think it was a very excellent suggestion. You know, and I think we can start in the home by having parents work with their kids, as an earlier caller suggested, to help them be comfortable in the kitchen, help them learn how to cook things, easy things in the beginning, and sort of have them get this level of comfort with what they can do with food. We can start in the home, and perhaps we need to think about it in schools. In the old days, I took home ec, and I learned to cook in home ec. You know, I had already learned at home, but so I think we're not doing as much of that as we used to do.
And of course, it was only the girls
who
took home ec.
Very true. Very true.
I think the point the caller makes is, I think that guys particularly, because it may be the girls instead of growing up, may be more likely to be doing stuff in the kitchen at home. And then guys get on their own, and they have no idea what to do.
How do you boil that egg?
Well, first, get some water. We're just about the point that we're going to have to finish. Is there any sort of last kind of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
I'd like to just say that, you know, my colleagues at the Family Resilience Center, Reed Larson in particular, and I have really been giving a lot of thought to increasing, setting the stage for improving family resilience from the bottom up, from everyday things that families can do together. Mealtimes may not be the sort of Norman Rockwell picture that we have in our minds, but they provide opportunities. And if parents and folks in the community are ready and willing and able to take those opportunities, they're very rich for improving children's development and their, you know, eventual moving out into society on their own.
Yeah. Well, our guest this morning here, Angela Wiley, along with Reed Larson, will be talking about mealtimes as opportunities for raising resilient children. This is the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program Spring 2006 lecture. It takes place next Monday, April 17th, 7:30 in the evening at the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. It is open to anybody who would like to attend, so you should feel welcome to stop by. Again, our guest is Assistant Professor of Applied Family Studies in Human and Community Development and also Extension Specialist in Family Life Education. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.